Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's April 10th, 2016, and welcome to episode 124 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know.
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, and landing on the moon. I'm your host with the most, Earl Evans. I'm here in Portland, Oregon, and we've got our regular irregulars with us. Lots of excellent retro commentators, beginning with Paul Hagstrom out in Massachusetts. Paul, how are you doing today?
I'm doing pretty well. As we usually talk about the weather, I will mention that spring does appear to be starting to get here. So that's the main thing. I can see it out the window.
That's good. That's good. And it technically, the area that you're in would qualify as New England?
I think so. I heard somebody debating that just a couple days ago about like it being
really?
Only the original, like having to do with, I think... now I forget Maine's place in it or something like that, but yeah. I think Massachusetts is probably pretty solidly New England.
Okay, because I've heard that the New England spring is really a beautiful time.
Looking forward to to seeing it out the window.
Nice. All right, so going around the globe to a place, though, that the seasons do tend to be the same as me, Mr. Jack Nutting in Sweden. Jack, how are you, sir?
Hi, Earl. I'm doing pretty well. It's not really, if we're going to stick to the weather theme, I don't feel like it's really spring in Sweden. I say it's shifted to another gray winter. Sweden has many gray winters throughout the year. But in spite of that, we've been doing some spring cleaning. So I've been spending almost all my weekend cleaning parts of the house that you don't often clean.
Ugh. That's inspiring. And I need to do the same thing, including the garage. I really want to make my garage a workable space for this coming summer. And I've got some things. Oh, you know what? That's something that I want to talk to you guys about, but I'll wait until the end when we go around the table because I saw something that's really exciting, but I'm going to make you wait. okay, so going to the place where the seasons are inverted, or Michael might say that they're actually proper. Michael Mulhern in Australia. How are you today?
I'm very good, thank you. Yes, out of the door for down here in the 8-bit bunker, I can see the first turnings of autumn. We have a few deciduous trees here on the acreage, and they're starting to go from green to the yellows and orange, but most of it is still the same. Beautiful old eucalypts and other native trees are just keep on green.
That sounds awesome. And also, I shouldn't ask you how you are today. I should ask you how you are tomorrow, because technically, I'm always talking to you the next day. It's weird. It's just time zones. How do they work?
Well, yes, it's magic. No, I've been still on the end of a jackhammer and just finishing off leveling a spot to build a shed, because... might come up later on, but yeah, I'm wanting to get stuff out of my garage as well, like the ride-on mower and the trailer and all the other things that are sort of making a two-car garage very squeezy for three cars.
Ah, okay. And you're out where you have some property now, so this is a possibility. Great.
Yeah, I wish I just had a bit more flat stuff, that's all. So I'm having to carve the flat stuff out of the lumpy sandstone stuff.
It's good. It builds character.
Oh, builds muscle ache.
So let's talk about the host topic for this time around. First off, what inspired us? We want to congratulate those clever folks over at SpaceX because they blasted off a rocket and then they actually got the stage one of the rocket to come back home and make a safe landing. The YouTube video of this, if you haven't seen it, you got to see this. And of course, the SpaceX people there at their mission control, where is that? Hawthorne, California? I think it's close to my old stomping grounds there. They were high fives all around, and it's really cool. But we thought, you know, we've kind of experienced the thrill of landing a craft decades ago with Lunar Lander, and Michael had this great idea that let's talk about the various incarnations of the Lunar Lander program.
I just want to interrupt there, Earl.
Sure.
None of my landings was successful. Every time I played that game, I created a new crater on the moon.
Yes. And so, well, let me talk about that, because I had just about the same luck as you, Michael. The one that I remember playing, I think, the most was Tranquility Base on the Apple II. And a friend of mine had an Apple II, and we would play games like Castle Wolfenstein, and we would play this one, Tranquility Base, and I never made a successful landing either. Just in preparation for the podcast here, I went out and I looked at a couple other incarnations. One is the Commodore 64 had Jupiter Lander. So I was thinking, when you've got sprites and 64K, why settle for the moon? However, since Jupiter's a gas giant, I'm not sure how this would work. But, you know, I guess that's half the fun, looking for somewhere to land, right?
Well, and I guess we had a lot of problems with space war and gravity. I would imagine trying to land on Jupiter, even if you could find the land, would be even worse.
It would suck, definitely. I tried one also for the pet. That was horrible. I died immediately. I didn't try it again. I've never made a that I know of, I don't think I've ever made a successful landing at this game. But let me go around the table and find out. Michael, it sounds like you weren't any more successful than I was at this.
I was exceedingly successful in my unsuccessfulness, be the best way. Now, there's a few Lunar Lander style programs that I remember playing. There was one which I think is very similar to the PDP one that you're referring to. It's more of a tabular type thing, and you've got your burn rate and everything, and it's a bit light on graphics. But the one I remember having the most fun with, and I couldn't find it on any of my discs here, it was a ASCII character graphic game. So you had a little lunar module made up of a couple of letters, and then with the slashes for the legs, and then the V character flicking on and off in between as the thrust. And that sort of came in at the top. You didn't get to see where the starting spot was, and then you basically had arrow keys and thrust keys to try and maneuver yourself into hopefully a flat piece of lunar real estate that would be scrolling probably from right going to the left, as is the traditional direction. And most of the time, even if I did find a flattish area to land on, I came in too hard, too fast.
Sorry.
It was lots of fun.
It was fun. It was a fun game. Jack, did you fare any better in your astronaut attempts?
I can't actually remember. Like, I remember playing a lot of games like this. I was looking around and I was trying to figure out what I played. I remember playing games of this sort on my Atari 8-bit back in the day. I found out that Adventure International, they actually had a version of this called exactly Lunar Lander. And I looked at a video and that's not what I played. But I remember playing games like this. There were probably some magazine type-in games like this and maybe something else. I remember that I really liked this idea. I really liked these kind of games. And I remember trying to do some attempts at programming and building a game like this as well. But I'm sure that didn't get anywhere. But I also remember playing I think it was the original Vector arcade game, Lunar Lander, that I remember playing.
The one from Atari.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I remember playing that. and just doing terribly because, right, I was, you know, however old I was probably 8 or something and had a limited amount of quarters to actually even try and get the thing to work. So I didn't do any well. But I remember a couple, a few years later then playing on my computer and having a lot of fun with it. But I can't off the top of my head remember if I ever successfully landed any of them, any of the landers in any of the games I played. Because I remember it was always, everyone I played, it was always really, really hard. Maybe that's why, maybe this sort of thing is why people like us are super excited about SpaceX actually landing this thing, because it seemed so impossible at the time.
Right. Yeah, it's not easy. But Paul, save us. Somebody here had to make some successful landings.
No, sorry, I can't say that I did either.
We're all dead.
Yeah.
Lunar Lander killed us.
Notice that none of us work at SpaceX.
That's true. That's probably
for the
fortunate.
Yeah.
I'm just hoping they put the handbrake on before they started doing the high fives.
Oh, my. Which variants did you play, if any, Paul?
Well, I haven't played any recently, but... yeah, I'm pretty sure I also played Tranquility Base a little bit. I looked around and I recall seeing an Apple I Lunar Lander. I'm not sure if it was contemporaneous with the release of the computer. It might have been. There's a good article that we had a link in the show notes for by it's about the history of the Lunar Lander game by Benj Edwards. I think, is that right?
That's right, on Technologizer.
Yeah, so he kind of goes through, there's some of the same information as on Wikipedia, but of course less well written, but going through sort of how Jim Storer, 17-year-old Massachusetts high school student, around the time of the Apollo 12 launch had written a lunar landing game in Focal for a PDP-8. And eventually, that one is probably the one that's likely... Oh, yes, right. Okay, so David All translated this into BASIC and put it in his 101 BASIC computer games book, and that spread it everywhere. But that was basically no graphics. You sort of, you know, changed the thrust and the probably the orientation of the whatever rocket. So I think I've tried that. I don't think I succeeded at that either. But it is interesting just how long it's lasted.
Yeah, this is one of the oldest, I guess, of the seminal computer games that we all remember. And that article on Technologizer is very well written. It's tough to beat Benj Edwards in terms of writing style. I really enjoy the things he puts together. Also, if you want to take a look at some of the variants, we got a link that'll be in the show notes over on Moby Games. And they have quite a few different versions of Lunar Lander. If you are in the mood for some thrusting and crashing, then head on over there and pick one of these for your favorite platform, and I'm sure you'll be crashing just like the rest of us. So, listener feedback. I think I'm going to turn this one over to Paul, because you are the undisputed king of listener feedback. So this time around, what do we got?
Well, we actually had quite a lot of people write in this time around. Terry Tezza wrote to alert us to the fact that the DigiBarn newsletter is up and running again. And I did not know that there was a DigiBarn newsletter, but DigiBarn newsletter number 24, DigiBarn Reboot. It is the first issue after 7 years. So my own sort of re-entry into the retro computing world was more recent than that, so I didn't even know this existed. But
gotcha.
But, very interesting. It's sort of going over what's happened since 2009 at the DigiBarn, which is also, if you are not aware of what it is, it's basically Bruce Damer is the curator / collector of the, you know, the computers that he keeps in a barn on a farm in California somewhere. So that's the DigiBarn. And it looks like he's starting to go through and sort things. He's sort of talked about some of the stuff that he did in relation to Apple's 40th anniversary. There's a couple really kind of interesting things on that in the newsletter that he points to. There's a little video. It was a Voice of America story about Apple turning 40, and he was interviewed on that. And I noticed that his Mac SE had a hard drive that's named OOOOROOXRR, etc., which is a common problem of public Macs of the System 6 era, because I forget exactly how it happens. I think it's just very easy. Like, if you click on the hard drive, then you are editing the name.
Oh, I get it.
So, but, and he also has a podcast. I don't think it's generally about retro computing, but the last couple of things on his podcast feed, Levity Zone, are an audio file of Steve Wozniak visiting the Digibarn, and then the audio from a panel at VCF 9.0 from 2006 at the Apple 30th anniversary. So this had Steve Wozniak, Randy Wigginton, Chris Espinoza, Daniel Kottke, and Bruce. And some of that is on YouTube as well. So anyway, lots of interesting stuff there. I'm glad that Tezza pointed that out, because I wouldn't have noticed it. Has anyone else had a Digibarn experience?
I came across the Digibarn website a few times, but yeah, I've been reading the back issues of the newsletter, so it's good that it's started up again, and it's one of those places where if you ever get in around there, it sounds like a place you've got to go and see.
You know, I don't think it's actually a public space exactly, so you probably have to arrange it with him. But I know that he does have people over there. So. Mm.
Just the bits and pieces which I've seen just browsing for this, it's just amazing the bits that he's got. I just would love to sort of see them.
Definitely, yeah. And I think actually he does, as I say, it's somewhere between a collection and a museum, because he does people have I remember that there definitely are some Apple III relics that have gone there. And those are the ones I'm aware of. I know that other people have donated things there too. So it's a significant enough organization that people think it's safe to do so. But okay, let's see. In other news, Norbert wrote, he is the wizard behind massvirk.at, or mass:work, I don't know. But, So we were talking about Easter eggs last time, and he mentioned that, one of the animation, you know, simulation things he has on his site is called Google 60, which is using Google as if in the era of Mad Men. So you type in something, and it goes onto a punch card, and then it gets fed into a thing and comes out on a line printer. And he mentioned that there's an Easter egg in there if you type list games, and you can kind of guess where it'll go from there. But he also suggests if you do that, then ask for advice on which side to choose. And there's an extra Easter egg. But
wow. Okay. That's pretty cool. So an Easter egg, which in itself is kind of a retro idea, in a retro simulation. Mm-hmm. So good on them.
He sent us a pretty detailed email about kind of putting... we had been talking about his Space War emulation, which, you know, I guess is kind of in a vague way related to the Lunar Lander stuff. But he actually got email from Steve Russell, who I think must have been behind that in the first place. He was very excited to have gotten that, and that kind of inspired Norbert to kind of, like, you know, enhance the history part of it. And he went through, so there's a page on his site that goes through sort of the history of Space War, and it's quite involved. But anyway, unfortunately, the email is so long, I feel like I can't really read the whole thing out loud here. But thank you for writing, Norbert. And he did mention that it is a one-man operation. It is not a team. It is actually him doing all these amazing things.
Wow. So pats on the back to Norbert, because what cool stuff over there. I've wasted more than my fair share of time on that site. And I shouldn't say wasted, because I enjoyed every minute of it.
Another thing that said, so Bob wrote in and pointed us to a link that I'd seen going around, kind of the social network. I have only written here Connor K.
But he's the young man who got the mainframe, right?
Yes.
Yes, right. Yeah, so Connor Kukowski is his name. And so he, apparently he was at 18, maybe he's 18 now, I don't know, but he's that sort of age. And Rutgers University was getting rid of an old mainframe, an IBM Z890. And so he bought it for, quote, $240. I'm sure that all of the incidental costs after that $240 were non-trivial, but
outweighed it. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I'm not sure if much can outweigh this.
I'm not sure if it outweighed it.
But
they're big. They're big. They're heavy.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. But so he was actually invited to speak, invited or accepted, I'm not sure, to speak at the Share conference, which I think has come up before, but it's basically like IBM-endorsed user group meeting that's been going on forever among mainframe users mostly. But so there's a YouTube video of his presentation at Share where he sort of goes through getting the mainframe, getting it into his basement, and working all the way up until getting it started. And it's pretty interesting, and I think it's pretty cool, actually, you know, or brave, even to present this to the mainframe people. And you know, and I think they thought it was pretty interesting too. He did questions at the end, and it's a pretty involved video, and he's got pictures of all the steps as it goes along. So definitely worth taking a look at. Did any of you watch it when it was when it was making the Twitter rounds?
Well, what I watched was some of the streams that he did on Twitch.
Mm.
This is Connor Krukowski, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, he had a Twitch.tv channel, Con Mega, and I had gone over there and I had watched actually as he was trying to get the Minecraft server software to run on his Z890.
Cool.
And it was really pretty interesting when he went over to the IRC channel for Minecraft support. He was like, hey, I'm having a little trouble lighting this up on my Z890 mainframe. And it's like, oh, and by the way, I'm not trolling. So, yeah, it's he's amazing. That's just and the presentation that he gave up on YouTube, I think there's like a one-hour prezo on there that is really cool. So, yeah, man, it's good stuff.
Yeah, it's way I would not be quite that brave, but I think when you're 18, you know, the consequences seem less big. You know, what consequences?
Right.
Maybe my parents won't notice this thing in the basement.
Yeah, or the electric bill.
Yeah.
Or their electrician coming in to put in the 3-phase 30-amp supply.
Right. Might be a little bit like the telephone charges of the mid-80s.
Oh, the BBS era, yeah.
Let's see. Okay, yes. Continuing along, Tony sent a few links. One of the things that he mentioned was that he attended a screening of the 8-bit generation movie at the Computer History Museum. And he sent us a couple of photos, which I will look at while you listen to me talk. It sounds like it was pretty neat. They had a little panel discussing it. So Bill Hurd was on the panel, Bruno Grampa, who was the filmmaker, and John Holler, I think, from the Computer History Museum. And Chuck Peddle was there asking a question in one of the photos. And sounds like it wasn't entirely full, but it was a neat event. So I'm looking forward to actually seeing the movie when it happens. It seems to have a lot of interviews with Jack Trammell, is that how you say it?
Trammell, I think.
Trammell.
I've heard.
I knew it's something other than the way it's spelled.
Right.
And you know, so it's good that those got captured and are now soon to be available. So thanks, Tony, for going and for reporting on it. And I thought that was actually pretty cool, having Chuck Peddle physically there asking a question, because I think he's often not in the country, right?
I thought he was in Sri Lanka. I thought that's where he... Well, but that was some years ago, so I don't actually know where he's at these days.
Oh, yeah, you talked to him for, like, a long time on Skype once, didn't you?
Yeah, we had an interview that we did on Retrobits that was really cool, and he was over there working on technologies to recover flash memory that was partially defective, but then put it together to make actual working flash memory at a dramatically reduced cost. So it sounded like cool technology, and man, he was just feisty and energetic as ever.
Yeah, I loved listening to those. It was he's really quite entertaining, and it does seem like you can kind of just put the microphone in front of him and say go, and you know, clear your throat every once in a while, and
yeah,
that's all you really have to do.
And great stories, yeah.
Let's see. Okay, lots of feedback. Retroist had Tony sent another couple of links. One of them is that Retroist, it's a website / podcast, had an interview with the National Video Game Museum co-founder Joe Santulli, and just to say a little bit about that, it's in Frisco, Texas. So North Texas, I guess this is. Rapidly growing city north of Dallas. The National Video Game Museum is open now. I think it opened at the beginning of the month, and it has such rarities as the unreleased Atari Mind Link controller, and you know, like it's a museum, it's a video game museum, and it looks pretty nice. We on Facebook, I'm not sure if it might have been actually on the Apple II group and not on our Facebook page, but Mike posted some photos of being there just recently, and I thought it was kind of cool, and I even wanted to keep this as a mention just because I'm pretty sure that the Apple IIe that they have set up there is in fact one that I helped assemble. So like the monitor that they're using, I think, used to be in my office downstairs.
So, wow, neat.
That was pretty cool. Yeah, for PAX East 2013, Ken, also of our podcast, sort of helped organize, and I forget exactly what parts he was responsible for, and another friend, Wayne, and a different Mike helped kind of like assemble the software, and the I think Wayne gave us the actual IIe, and I provided the monitor, but this was so that there would be some representation of Apple II at the PAX game room. But I think it went from there to the National Video Game Museum. So that was neat. And it looks like it would be interesting to go see. So any of you near Texas?
I am not. I'm about as close to Texas as you are.
Yeah.
Where in Texas is this?
It's north of Dallas.
Okay. Because I'm in Texas sometimes, but never there. Or seldom there. Yeah. It's a big place, Texas.
It is, yeah. It's not like saying, you know, if it's in Rhode Island, just you know, getting from any one place to another is not a big deal. But okay, so much feedback. I think I'll stop with the last one I wanted to mention is that on our Facebook group, Charles posted that he had at an estate sale found a couple of really interesting things. So one was a Vectrex. He was very excited about that to actually get a hold of this, and then he got a box that was labeled BDC 6500 computer, and I don't know if he knew what was in there before he got it home, but he opened it up, and it's basically a box for a Kim 1. So it had a Kim 1 in there as well, and that's pretty cool. I'm very envious. So anyway, if you want to see pictures of the Kim 1 board,
I'll raise your envious with a teeth grind.
Yeah. Yeah, I have started looking at estate sales. I have things getting emailed to me now, but there was one not too long ago that I failed to go to that seemed to have a whole like Coleco Adam box, but usually it's not that. Usually it's just a bunch of dishes, but
right.
You know,
right.
Occasionally sometimes in there is something interesting.
Very hit and miss, but a good find.
Yeah, that's
good finds.
These are astounding.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Last time I went to something like that, it was supposed to have old computers, but there were only Pentium 2s.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, 1990s computers, not as interesting.
Nope.
Mm.
I'm starting to think that, you know, looking at, you know, as we look for things on eBay and stuff, I have been looking in the vintage computing category, and it's, you know, it's not going to be long before that's going to include a lot of things that I don't want to look at.
That's true. That's true. And that's probably okay. But you're right. I mean, the definition of retro changes as we get older, right?
Yeah. But not the definition of interesting.
That's right. Well said.
Yes. Anyway, I think we can leave it with that for feedback. But thank you to those who wrote and to Tony for all the links that we didn't mention. But maybe some of them we'll mention below. Below meaning later.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And Jack, moving over, pivoting to the items of interest, it sounds like you have an article about our chiptune heroes, 8-Bit Weapon.
That's right. And this actually is another one, courtesy of Tony. Thank you again, Tony. 8-Bit Weapon is one of my favorite chiptune artists. I'm a person who actually, I like the idea of chiptunes as sort of a genre, but in general, I don't like a lot of what I actually hear. But these are one of the exceptions. I really like what 8-Bit Weapon does, along with the side project of one of them called Compute Her. Anyway, so this is Seth and Michelle Sternberger. They are a couple. I presume they're married, unless they just happen to randomly have the same last name. I don't think
be siblings.
No, because the article describes how they met, so they can't be siblings.
Ah, okay.
So they do shows, they do albums. Well, you know, albums. They don't like press vinyl or anything. It's all online. They have a really their latest one is one that I like a lot on Spotify. It's called Disassembly Language: Ambient Music for Deprogramming Volume 1. And it's an album with just four songs, but it's over an hour long because each song is very long. And it's kind of like, it's all fairly ambient. It's actually quite nice to have on playing when you want to have some noise in your ears, but don't want to have like anything that's energetic and is distracting you from what you're trying to do. Anyway, it's a very good article that describes sort of their process, how they work on things, how they write songs, and how they use different technologies. Like pretty much all of the stuff they record is actually recorded off of genuine vintage machines, not recorded off of like, say, simulators or emulators or anything. And they say that for the most part that works fine because most of the old 8-bit machines have a sort of monitor output of some kind that includes an audio signal. So it's pretty straightforward to record these things. Anyway, it's a very nice article. It's on a website called Chaos Control, which I've never seen before, but seem to have a lot of interesting articles on there about different bands, music making people. So if you like 8-bit Weapon or if you like chiptune music in general, you might want to take a look at this.
So the area of the world that you're in tends to be pretty receptive of chiptune music, I think, and retro music. Lots of the get-togethers that
yeah.
I've seen for that particular genre are up your way.
Yeah, there's a fair amount of that here. And if you look at there's a company, Teenage Engineering, they are actually making these interesting hardware devices that give you kind of chiptune-y effects and sounds. Like one thing they have, they have something called the OP1. They had it for a few years, which is a small, looks like a small MIDI keyboard controller, but actually contains on it software for doing sequencing, all kinds of stuff. And that's been out for a few years, and it costs like, I don't know, $800 or something. It's really out of my range for a toy. Then they have some nice new things that are sort of, they look like the size and shape of a small pocket calculator, and they have a similar amount of buttons and a small LCD display. And each one is kind of in its own instrument. Like there's one that's kind of a drum machine and one that's kind of a bass, and they're just sort of different things, but all of them have very sort of simplistic sounds that capture a lot of this quality that I like as well. I have not bought any of these yet, but I have a friend who's bought a couple. I need to sort of bend his ear and hear what he thinks about these things. But yeah, and that's a Swedish company. So there's a lot of interest in that kind of thing here for sure. Not that it influences that much of what you hear on the radio or anything like that. Like, I never have heard 8-bit Weapon on the radio. Although, actually, I have heard on the radio interesting things like fan-produced music about, like inspired by Minecraft. Things that things that I've heard my daughters listening to on YouTube. And then at some point I was like, oh, this thing's playing. It must be from my, you know, she must put it on my Spotify playlist. No, that's the radio playing.
Wow, cool.
Yeah. So.
Well, all right. Staying on the artistic topic, Michael, you've got something with the art of Atari, and I guess if you look at the word Atari, you can get the letters for the word art in there. So I don't that is not significant at all. So why don't you take it away?
That's very deep and profound there, Earl. No, art of Atari. Well, I've always loved effectively the art of the Atari games. I always thought of it as the game inside this box bears a passing resemblance to the artwork on the outside. But all of that aside, I have always loved the actual artwork on the game boxes. It was various artistic styles that most of us grew up with, and it's great to see a coffee table book coming out fairly realistically priced, only about $40 US, that shows all the different types of box art and advertising materials and accompanying materials that came with the game. So we could all easily get copies of the game's images, ROM images, disc images. That's fine. We can normally see some less than great scans of the boxes or the small inserts that go with it, but it is great to actually see some high quality imaging of these boxes, and it's just a great website to scroll through, even if you're not going to end up buying the book, and I will be. And then there's also a good article from USA Today on the author and what they were intending to do and what they have done with the actual book. But I always loved sort of comparing the artwork of the boxes to the actual game when you played it, and separate worlds.
Yeah, the box artwork often seems like wishful thinking.
Yes.
It's more like reading a book. You have to use your imagination.
Sure.
Yeah, I'm sure if I zoomed in on that one pixel enough, I would actually see that image of the hero.
Yep. Very cool. Yeah.
Paul, what have you got here? It looks like something that I really would like to have one for me.
Yeah, so continuing on again with art and books and so forth, there is a Kickstarter for Commodore VIC-20, A Visual History by Giacomo Vernoni. And so this is it's sort of like a coffee table book type thing that has photos of the VIC-20. There's a list of what's going to be in there, but pictures of the hardware, circuit boards, different models, the VIC modem, printers, drives, and then some of the boxes and the software manuals. And I think actually, new rewards, you can get 10 by 15 centimeter prints of all the game covers that I think all the 37 cartridge games produced by Commodore. And they look really nice. The photography, at least on the Kickstarter page, looks pretty good. And actually, the VIC-20 had some pretty good art too. I think they're sort of pleasant looking, very friendly, as it says. But they're looking for, or he is looking for, $22,320 U.S. dollars, and it is about halfway there with 2 weeks to go. So I did want to mention this because we will not record again before I think we know whether this succeeded or not, or at least just barely. So so if this is something you're interested in and you hadn't seen it before, if 10,000 of you put in a dollar, or however that goes. No, I think there are a number of different reward types. You can get supported and get the PDF, and you get one copy of the book in English for $32 US. That seems pretty reasonable. But you can go take a look at it. Some of the I'm not sure if it's all already photographed, but some of the stuff is photographed. And it looks good.
They must have known about our show in advance, because if you scroll through part two software, the first image there is for Jupiter Lander.
Nice. True. How true.
Excellent.
I bet I'd be bad at that as well.
Maybe today's whole episode is actually, we're secretly buzz marketing this book.
Yeah.
Well, I would not be opposed to that. I don't know how much time people would have after they hear our episode, so maybe we should tweet this out, too. What do you guys think?
Yeah, sure, yeah. That's fine.
Just to let people know if they're interested.
This one's worth it.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, nice find, Paul. Michael, Britain's first mass-produced commercial computer, what was it?
What the heck? It was the heck. So that is the, the Hollerith Electronic Computer. Made by BTM, or British Tabulating Machine Company. So some 1950s great company names. So basically this is just me and my love of heavy metal. And when I mean heavy metal, I mean the early computers. So this is a recent acquisition and restoration, is now on display at the British National Museum of Computing at Bletchley Park, and two places on my must-go-and-see list. But basically, the HEC was the first commercial mass-produced business computer in the UK. quite an interesting machine. There's some history here for it on the TM Mock page. And what I like is that it was really possibly one of the first computers to actually use a rotating media for memory. So in this case, it was using drum memory for storage. And then there's also quite a few other innovations, I suppose. Almost anything being built as a computer back then would have contained an innovation or two, but it's the Booth multiplier algorithm, which is a process which is still in today's computer design. So if anyone is in the area, you can now go into the National Museum of Computing, and it'll be alongside EDSAC and the original Witch. So there's quite a good exhibition of early British heavy metal out at the National Museum at Bletchley Park.
Wow. You know, I'm not really a bucket list kind of guy, but getting to the National Museum of Computing is definitely going on that list.
And it's also just into Bletchley Park itself. They have done some great restoration work on there for the World War II code-breaking efforts and the work there. And there's some great exhibits in there as well. And I think I could lose myself in both venues for at least a day or two each. It's
absolutely
definitely on my bucket list. But it is really the birthplace of modern computing.
Have you ever heard any of their podcast? Because on their podcast, they talk about some of the painstaking restoration work that they did to give a very accurate representation of what the complex looked like during those code breaking efforts, and it's fascinating the work they went to.
I'm always eagerly awaiting the next podcast episode for the Bletchley Park podcast. So if anyone's interested in early computing and where it all came from and code breaking, cryptanalysis, I'd suggest that they couldn't go far wrong to add the Bletchley Park podcast to their listening list.
Totally
cool.
Agree.
And I had no idea it existed, but I will add that to my listening list.
So what do we got here, Paul? You're in VIC-20 mode today.
Yeah, I guess so.
you're going to rob my piggy bank again, aren't you?
Yeah, this is a weird thing that I guess it was just announced like less than a week ago as we record, but it's the Ultimem. So Retro Innovations has made available the Ultimem VIC-20 memory expansion cartridge, and it's got 8 megabytes of flash ROM storage, so you know, you can put all your cartridges on there, and it's flash storage, so you can change your mind. You don't have to get, you know, one of the cartridges that has them all built in and not the third-party ones or whatever, homebrew. It also has an astounding 1 megabyte of RAM. So,
and how much would I have to pay for this, Paul?
Not much, actually. It's really quite amazing. It's so $50, in fact. Not to step out of the infomercial mode there, but it is really not very expensive.
That is so cool. One of the reasons that I haven't, you know, there are other expansion cartridges similar to this for the VIC-20, and one of them actually runs kind of in limited production mode and is $100, which is probably the only reason that I haven't jumped on getting one. But for $50 for this one, this is really tempting. I got to get my VIC-20 up and running again. I think I got some problems with the VIC chip, and I need to repair it so that then I can go ahead and buy this, because, wow.
Yeah, I am quite impressed. Yeah, I know where I saw this. In the product description on the actual page, you know, it says, "In public, you scoff at those pesky Commodore 64s with their RAM expansion units and the gratuitous way they waste all those kilobytes of RAM." But nevertheless, you know, here you can have an entire 1 megabyte. Take that, Commodore RAM expansion units. But it's not actually shipping yet. It will start shipping. They're aiming for April 27th, so end of the month. And I think you can pre-order it now. But you know, they're sort of right at the beginning of making these available. But that does look really cool. So I may have to get out of VIC-20 to to try this out.
Yeah, you can use a megabyte of RAM with your 22 character display.
Yeah.
So, yeah, don't spend it all in one place. That's all I'm saying. Yeah, I
could definitely put a few Lunar Lander games in that.
So, before we get to the host retro computing gift idea, a vintage news item from the RCR.
Roger, 1202, we copy it. 35 degrees, 750, coming down to 23. 540 feet, down to 15. 10 and 50 feet, down at 4. Altitude, velocity, light, 3.5 down, 220 feet. 5 and forward, coming down nicely, 200 feet, 4.5 down, 5.5 down. 100 feet, 3.5 down, 9 forward. 75 feet, guys looking good, down a half. 6 forward, 60 seconds. Lights on, forward, forward. 40 feet, down 2.5, picking up some dust. Great shadow. 4 forward, drifting to the right a little. 30 seconds. Forward, just. Contact light. Okay, engine stop. We copy you down, Eagle.
Listen, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
And we're back. Hope you enjoyed that. And if you didn't recognize the sound of what was going on there, shame on you. All right. The host retro computing gift idea. Have you guys ever seen one of these? These are cool. It is a 3D model kit. It's, I guess, laser cut metal. And you get these metal sheets, and then you bend the metal and use the tabs and the slots for the structural integrity to put the thing together, and it becomes a model of something. In this case, it's a model of the Apollo lunar module, and it just looks gorgeous. Now, I bet when I build mine, it won't quite look like this. It might take a couple of attempts, but I just never seen one of these, and to my eye, this is beautiful.
Yeah, it looks amazing, and for $10, it's quite the thing. This I've not seen these before at all. This looks very cool.
Yeah, so yeah, 6 by 6 by 5.5 centimeters. That's quite a respectable size.
If you go over to the Fascination site, you'll see that they have all kinds of models of various aircraft and other sorts of things, buildings, and it all looks really nice. But I figured theme of the show was this one, and you know, you could build a few of these. I mean, at the price, and so the eBay seller that I'm looking at here has this for $9.99 and free shipping, and they're coming out of Akron, Ohio. But I noticed there's more than one place that you can buy these, so you've got your choice really of some different options of where to purchase them. But just anyway, thought it was a cool nerd gift.
That is really nice, and it really, really seems very cheap to me. Yeah. I guess I'm getting acclimated to eBay prices or whatever, but I mean, how can you not buy this for $10?
Yeah, exactly, and you have the fun of putting it together, too.
Yeah.
So that's my gift idea, and now I guess some other ways to spend money. We'll go to eBay auctions. I saw on eBay an Amiga 1200 that looked like it was in really nice shape. And they said that they turned it on and it asks for a diskette, which is a good sign. That means it's got a video display and that it acts like it's doing something. In this eBay auction, there are also some shrink-wrapped diskettes. Not quite sure what that's all about. I suppose there's a chance the machine wasn't used. I mean, the person says the unit looks brand new. The package doesn't look like it's ever been opened, but they don't claim new in box, which I think is very ethical of them. They just say that's the way it looks. But as I went through here, the keyboard looks very clean. The package software looks good. They show various pictures of the front, back, top, bottom. So I don't know what you guys think, but I mean, it's still got 6 days and 21 hours, and it's already up to $60 with 6 bids. So I can't vouch for how much this is going to go for, but look like a nice unit.
Yeah, I think it looks really nice.
It does look new. So the 1200, I don't know how these numbers work. Is the 1200 a good Amiga? All Amigas are good Amigas, I know, but...
I think it was contemporaneous with the... You used that word earlier in the podcast. I had to sneak it in somehow. I think with the 600, wasn't it? Didn't the 600 and 1200 come out around the same time?
Yeah, the 600 and the 1200 and the 4000 are all sort of... Those are sort of the last Commodore Amiga machines. And they all had, like significantly upgraded graphics compared to the earlier ones. And and so the 4000 was kind of almost out of everyone's price range. And so if you wanted to have the awesome new Amiga in the early 90s, it was the 1200 that you typically were going for.
Which is also kind of nice because it means it's got a later manufacture date and thus, you know, a little bit longer to live before the cosmic rays manage to bombard the chips inside it. Yep. So anyway, that's my eBay pick. Let's see what some of the rest of you have got. Jack, what's your pick?
I've got something. Actually, before though, I wanted to back up on yours. I noticed on one of the pictures, it actually shows that it's the Amiga 1200 HD, which I believe means that had a built-in hard drive.
I believe you're right, sir.
Which not all of them did, so that's even cooler.
Like the 600 HD, one of which I had at one point, which had the internal hard drive.
Yeah. Cool. Anyway, what I have is very much on the theme of what we were talking about today, which is Lunar Lander. This is Lunar Lander for the Atari 8-bit computers by Adventure International, which was Scott Adams' company. They're known mostly for doing these text adventures, but they did some graphics software as well. And this is one of them. It's on diskette for the Atari 400, 800, etc. It says
it's
that
it's affordable.
It says that it's affordable for some people. The current buy it now price is 620 euros. That's a lot.
What's that, about 20 bucks?
Yeah, 20 bucks.
Yeah, I'm sure.
And, and some change.
20 bucks, yeah. And 680 bucks. So, but it does say you can make an offer, and it's the auction is up for another 26 days, so we'll see. Yeah, I don't know. It says that it's actually new. I'm trying to look at the package. It looks like it might actually be shrink wrapped. I'm not sure. I see looks like plasticky around it, but I'm not quite sure. But whether that means it's worth 620 euros, I cannot judge.
A new in box Adventure International game like that probably would go for some pretty good money, but I don't know. Yeah. That's kind of spendy, especially when the provenance is unknown, and how do you know it hasn't been opened and reshrinked?
Right. Mm-hmm. Yep. Don't know. And there's no, and they have some text written about this, but it's all in German, which means we cannot know.
Mm.
This language is impenetrable. We cannot know what it is. I'm sorry.
You know,
it does say actually new and sealed.
Yep.
It does make that claim.
It claims that, so. Anyway, that's what I found.
Interesting. Yeah, I was going to say, I'm fairly sure that this seller specializes in this kind of thing and specializes in like the tenfold increase on what you expect to spend on any one thing. So they're definitely interesting pictures to look at. I'm not surprised at the price from this particular in this particular venue, but
right.
All right. Well, and like Jack observes, there is a make offer. So I always like when they do that. They're free to entertain offers and to turn them down if it's not to their liking. But I always appreciate when somebody offers that button on eBay. And I'm being totally serious here. I think that's it gives you the notion that this is negotiable. And so if the price is way off, you know, like if this is an order of magnitude more than what it ought to cost, then they'll find that out because people have an opportunity to communicate it to them.
Yep.
So Michael, what have you got for us?
Well, I'll bend this one into our theme. So if you were wanting to play Lunar Lander, an Apple II version, let's say, and all you had was a Tandy 1000 or a similar early IBM PC, then the TrackStar 128 is what you need. So here's a, I believe it's a ISA card that you can plug into your, let's go with the Tandy 1000 because it's not an IBM PC, well, on the outside. So here's a card, slot it in, and hi-ho and off you go. You can run Apple II software.
Wow. It like kind of like the Apple II card for the Mac LC.
Yep. So yeah, it's interesting. So I love it from both the point of view of just having it as it is, but also as a Tandy or a early Apple enthusiast, this gives you a crossover ability as well. It's just a great find. And there seems to be some interest in it at the moment. There's 50 bids. It's increased slightly from its opening price of 99 cents. So it's up to $222.66 now. And I'm sure there's plenty of upward movement on this one. And I just love these old bits and pieces of hardware that pop up that just show how people were thinking back in the 80s and late 80s, early 90s of multi-purposing your hardware. It's great. If I had a Tandy 1000, I'd be in on this one on a shot.
I think the funniest one that I've seen of this genre is the Apple II upgrade for the Commodore 64.
Yes.
Where you actually slide this monstrosity onto the back of the Commodore 64, and it's basically just an Apple innards that then work through the Commodore 64. It's hilarious. Anyway, but this is much nicer.
Speaking of that, there's also, what is it, the Mac Charlie that allows you to run PC on your early Macs?
I don't know that one.
And it basically almost envelops from one side of the Mac. am I misremembering something?
My PC ate my Macintosh.
Burp.
What else do you have for us, Michael?
Okay, well, continuing along on the... More than one. One of my favorites. I used to use one of these back at university. It's the ThunderScan digitizer. So, pop out the cartridge in your image writer, and then pop in this scanner cartridge, and basically you now have a scanner that you can hook up to your Mac. I used to use one on a Apple II, off you go. So when you finish scanning, you can put your your ribbon cartridge back in, and then print out your image. So I believe this one is for, I'm just having a look at it. Looks like an Image Writer 1. That's basically what I've got hooked up to both my PC and my Apple II. Just another interesting way of multi-purposing retro hardware. Back when it wasn't retro hardware.
That is awesome also. Wow, really neat finds. And I've never heard of one of these ThunderScan devices, but that's innovative.
Yeah, I think it is a really kind of neat way to do, to do that, like to solve the scanning problem. You've already got a machine that will relatively precisely position a printhead. Might as well put a lens there.
Feeding a book through might be a bit difficult.
Yeah. At folklore.org, so this is the... and. I think it's Andy Hertzfeld's collection of stories about the Mac, but he and maybe also Bill Atkinson worked on the software for the ThunderScan to get, to sort of like deal with the fact that it was getting a line of data at a time and having to line it up and so forth. But so it has some history to it as well.
Awesome. Well, Paul, while you've got the microphone, why don't you tell us about your eBay goings on?
All right, so let's see. I have the first thing is it's called an eProbe or Vernier experiment kit. There's a serial box interface and it has a bunch of sensors. There's a light sensor and I think this is a temperature sensor. This has a little box with the eProbe logo on it and it has a general science activities guide that comes with it. And it's kind of neat if you like, sort of having your computer connect to the outside world and sense things. You know, this is kind of cool. It caught my attention partly because I have, I got a couple of eMates, eMate 300s. These are little Newton machines that look like the clamshell iBooks. And it came with some of this stuff from, it was like, I think a teacher or something had it in a school. So I've had a chance to play around with some of these things. I have one of the interface boxes and some of these sensors, and it's pretty cool. Actually, I think I used the, I think there's a thing that will sense voltages, and I used it to check to make sure that my power supply was providing the right thing on a Apple II Plus motherboard. I thought that was kind of neat. But, you know, it's not very quick. The sampling rate is kind of low. But anyway, it's quite a complete set, and it's a buy it now for $20, and I don't understand why it hasn't sold yet, but there's still 5 days
left.
Well,
I can tell you why it hasn't sold, because it would cost me $50 to get it here to Sydney.
Yeah, right. but it looks neat. You know, a lot of times, to the extent that you find things like this, you know, these little sets, like Broderbund had a science kit as well, and a lot of times you only have like one of the sensors, or, you know, you're missing some important piece. This seems like it does have all the pieces. So it'd be fun to play with. I fully intend to get, you know, my instance of this out and play with it sometime before too long.
Nice.
Okay. Yeah, the next thing I have, something that came up, it's a bit pricey, but it's unusual enough. I thought I would mention it. It is a expansion box for Laser 128 or 128EX. So the Laser is I think it's a 2C clone, and the 2C was not expandable. The Laser is, you know, the same, basically the same form, but it has this weird, like, slot in the side. I don't know if you've seen this, but if you wanted to put in an interface card, you actually, it just hangs out the side of the computer. It's expandable.
It's just an exposed naked card with the, yeah, with the slot connector. So you just literally plug it in.
It's very frightening. but they did make an expansion box, and that's what this is. So this is a thing that plugs into the unit, and then within an actual casing, there are two slots for, you know, two Apple II compatible cards that you can put in there. I believe that these are, I mean, like, the Laser 128 itself is a little bit hard to find now. I think these are super hard to find. And this has a starting bid of $200, and it, that sort of reflects that it may not actually be crazy. Although I'm not actually sure that they're going to get any bids at that start, but it is unusual anyway. So, and a neat thing. I think actually, I will find the post on Blake Patterson's site, but I think he's at least had one of these and you know, talked about connecting it and showed photos of it, set up and stuff. So soon in the show notes there will be that. Nobody played with a Laser in their youth. I was only vaguely aware of them.
No, I never had the chance. I don't think I've ever even seen one in person.
Mm. No, it was something I always read about here. I don't think they really made it for sale to the market down here in Australia that much, but I always read with much interest about them because they just seem to have that little bit of an edge over the equivalent Apple products, and it was that expansion. As much as I love my Apple IIc, I'd be quite happy if it had just a slot strip on the side, so I could just plug an extra card in. And now I would have ended up making something for it, to, you know, probably something along the lines of this product here, just with whatever was around. But yeah, it was a machine I was aware of, very interested in, but I've never actually got to put fingerprints on one.
Yeah, the non-expandability of the 2C is the thing that keeps me from liking it. But
well, it's got almost everything you could possibly ever need, right, except for a real-time clock, a hard drive, good graphics. But apart from that, it's great. I love it.
All right.
You do need to talk about the next couple things here, because these are amazing eBay finds. I don't know how you do it.
I have no idea either. But all right. So the first one is an AMAX 2 Plus Apple Macintosh emulator for Amiga 2000. So this is, you know, again, sort of like system in another system kind of thing.
So cool.
Yeah. So I don't actually know. I think this might be still like a going thing. Like it's I haven't yet figured out if this is vintage or new. But at any rate, what it is you know, it's something you attach to your Amiga 2000 and it will run Mac software. So, I mean, like actual Mac software, right?
Yeah, I think this one's for Mac 2. There's the AMAX 1, which I believe does the 128, 512, and the Mac Plus.
Aha, yes, here we are. There is an AMAX homepage that actually has information.
That
says exactly what you said.
Yep.
Cool. So now I need to get an Amiga to put it in, and then this. But it appears to be just one of them. But if they are, maybe there will be more. If this is something being manufactured now. It does say copyright 1992 though, so
yeah, this is definitely retro stuff. This was current then, I remember.
Uh-huh.
Back when I had an Amiga, I remember this being a thing. But since I never had an Amiga 2000 or any of the expandable ones, that was not really a thing for me at all. But
uh-huh.
I remember hearing about this.
No, the main reason I put the link in for the AMAX was basically so that all the software, there's links there for all the disk images. So it's quite a good resource there. So if anyone out there in listener land wants to put some money down on this, there is software available.
Hmm. So I see that there are two vacant sockets there that say low ROM and high ROM, and I'm guessing that what you're supposed to do here is buy a Mac 2, take the ROMs out, put them in this,
yes.
And then put them... Yeah,
that was the way all these things worked for both the Amiga and for the Atari STs, which worked, there were some similar things, where you had to get the ROMs from somewhere. So supposedly it was possible to buy Mac ROMs from authorized Apple retailers or repair centers. Mm-hmm. But that was the way to do it, right? Because otherwise, mm-hmm. if you already had a Mac...
Right.
In front of you, there was no point to pull the ROMs out and put it in your Amiga. That just didn't make any sense. But apparently there was a way to source them semi-legally if you found
an
agreeable
Mac retailer. And I'm sure
everyone
did that.
Right.
Yeah. I suppose you could burn your own these days and use those as well. Not being an expert, your mileage may vary.
Yep.
But it's a nice piece of hardware.
Yeah, and it's interesting. You know, it's interesting how people were trying to get as many sort of machines, as much use as they could out of their box and keyboard, basically.
Mm, yeah.
But okay, the next one is a HP 85, so calculating computer thing. It looks really nice, and the thing that I was actually sort of surprised by, apart from the fact that it started the bidding started. Low and reasonable, is that it does it has a lot of the stuff, you know. So it looks nice, but it has little. I suppose they're data tapes and the manuals and everything looks in good condition. It's shown to work. The keys all seem to type. Really looks nice. I know I've been sort of aware of these for a while. I've never myself used one, but it's one of these things that. I wouldn't mind having, but I haven't actively pursued, but I've seen them, and this is about the nicest I've seen.
You'll see 85s on eBay from time to time, but this is so complete with the carrying case and all the goodies and in this nice condition. I've never seen one like this.
Mm-hmm.
They're a peculiar kind of machine. We had... an 85 in one of the computer retail stores that I worked at, and just trying to figure out how to make the machine sing and dance was a little tricky. Its interface with BASIC was different than what I was used to on a lot of the other systems, and as you mentioned, it does kind of look like something in between a calculator, a piece of test equipment, and a computer, but it does have that quintessential early 80s computer sort of look to it, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's very interesting machine, and this particular listing is great.
And an eye strain monitor.
Yes, in the tiny little monitor. And it spoke the HPIB protocol, which I think was a variant of IEEE 488, but don't shoot me if I'm wrong on that.
I think you are correct. That sounds familiar from when I was trying to figure out what IEEE 488 was. But and they do have an adapter here, like a little piece of hardware that says HPIB interface, I think. It's a nicely kept machine. So it's very nice that they are making it available and not putting it in the dump. So the current bid is only $66. There are 6 days left as we record. And shipping is set to me at $60. So far, if it stopped now and I bid, it would be pretty reasonable. But I expect this will probably go up pretty high.
I think you're right.
So, let's see. I think the last one I'll mention is just kind of a goofy one, and it may be gone by the time this actually gets posted. But there's a vintage, the whole internet calendar for 1997, which is, you know, one of these page a day calendars, you know, with a little plastic back, from 1997. And there was a book called like the whole internet catalog or something like that, sort of went through like what websites there were at that point, because it was possible to do this in a book. But you can get this whole internet calendar, and it turns out that it will also work for the year 2031. So you can get it and use it then.
Yeah, buy it now. It'll probably cost more in 2031.
Yeah.
That's true. But as you point out, will we still have an internet?
Right.
2031.
It'll have high historical interest then. Buy now. Be prepared.
Well, yeah, people talk about the internet then like it's retro, right? People would be digging out their cable modems. So, okay, I guess that brings us to round the table. So let's kind of reverse the order here. Let's start with Michael. Parting shots?
Nothing much happening retro-wise here. As I said, I'm currently... just finished jackhammering out a flat area to build a shed so I can get stuff out of the garage. But the main goal of that is that down the end of the garage, which I can't use at the moment, is basically my soldering station. So I'm itching to get back in there and to get some projects done, especially the PIDP 8. I'd love to sort of get that done, but at the moment I don't have anywhere I can run the soldering iron.
Well, I'll make a plea to you or to Paul, whoever gets there first, to please video at least some of the build process as you put that thing together, because that would be amazingly fun to watch.
Watch Michael burn himself.
Right, that's exactly what I was thinking. Listen to creative swearing. And
yeah, at least I know how to hold on to a soldering iron, unlike some of that stock art that's been flying around.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Jack, parting shots, closing words, wisdom.
I just want to mention that the 2016 Basic 10 Liners contest that we've talked about before should be all wrapped up now or soon-ish. I think all the submissions had to be in by the end of March. So you should be able to very soon go to that website, wherever that is, and find the list of all the crazy 10-line programs people have submitted for simple games and stuff, of which I know... our friend Kevin Savitz has submitted at least like 4 or 5, I'm sure. Maybe 10, maybe 20.
Hey, you did it.
Yep. Ding, ding, ding.
It had to be done.
Well, that's right. Kevin Savitz. Nicely done.
Check.
Paul, what about you?
Well, I have an interesting thing that's coming up very quickly, actually. So later this afternoon, I will be preparing probably 2 Apple II Pluses to go to a video shoot. There's a German-French produced documentary series that I think is going to air in 2017. And the filmmaker's just coming in, I think, from Berlin on Wednesday to interview Dan Bricklin and Bob Frankston about the beginning of VisiCalc. And, you know, so he thought it would be kind of a neat idea to get them, you know, using the Apple II version, you know, the 1979 VisiCalc version on the original computer. And so he's going to film them setting it up and using it and do an interview with them. And it seems pretty cool. And I'm kind of pleased that I will be able to, you know, provide the machines that will be there. I think, you know, it's going to be a while till it airs, and when it airs, it'll be in and first it'll be in Germany and France, but they probably will at some point become available here. But it's so it's part of a series called How a Bunch of Nerds Have Changed Our Lives, and you know, he's going around to do interviews with a bunch of different people and here, and I think in San Francisco and various places. So
that's very exciting, and congratulations for being able to help their effort in that way. That is neat.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to seeing the final product, not just because my computers are in there, but I think it will be quite interesting to hear them talk about it. I found looking for this, I don't know why I found this, but anyway, these two, Dan Brooklyn and Bob Frankston, were on the cover of Inc. magazine in January 1982. I found on eBay, there was that issue is being sold, and it looks amusing, and they're quite young at that point. But, and there's a couple different articles in there that Inc.com itself has hosted it. The photos aren't there on the Inc.com site, but the text is, and talking about sort of designing VisiCalc and the birth of a new industry and so forth. It's pretty neat. Anyway, pretty excited to have that work. I hope I can find a working computer. But
yeah, and the you're right. They do look young on that Inc. magazine cover. Mm-hmm. And Dan Brooklyn's got the beard going, the chin full of win there.
I think neat. That's never changed.
It has not. Yeah. Very cool. Well, I'll tell you guys something that I've encountered. I saw a new products video for one of the electronics stores that I follow, online seller, MCM Electronics, actually, which is where I got some of my Raspberry Pi stuff. But they were showing this moldable plastic, and there are there are various forms of this. One, I think, was called polymold, and the other is polymorph. But if you go on eBay, you can find this stuff. Anyway, it's plastic that becomes moldable, pliable, taffy-like at about 140 degrees Fahrenheit. So you take it and you dunk it in some hot water, and it turns into its gooey self, and then you mold it into the form that you want, and then dunk it in some cold water if you want to accelerate the process. And when it cools down, it becomes plastic, hard plastic, that you could hang things on or use it to make a little case or drill through, because it actually becomes plastic-like at room temperature, but becomes moldable again. So if you've got shavings or clippings of something that you were working on before, you just dunk it back in the water, squish it again like Play-Doh, and it becomes moldable again. And I thought, this is a maker's dream, and especially if, there's certain things that you'd want to do on a 3D printer, but just because of the resolution and the precision and that, but certain things that you might just want to mold by hand or whatever. I saw one person on YouTube using this for artwork and crafts, where you have a mold, and you get this stuff gooey, and you stick it in the mold, and then you kind of clip around it and pull it out, and when it hardens, you've got a plastic doodad in the form of whatever that mold was. So I just thought this was great, yet another tool in the maker's toolbox. So I thought I would share that with our listeners, especially if you're trying to do something custom and, you don't need it to be perfect, but you do want it to be flexible. This might be your stuff.
Yeah, that does seem pretty useful for fixing little corners of something that's broken or whatever.
Oh yeah, another YouTube video showed it as enhancing tools. Like they took a knife, a kitchen knife that might be a little difficult to grip, and they put a big plastic grip on it that was actually molded to the person's fingers, to their actual hand grip. Also, there was another little tool for turning something like an Allen wrench or whatever that was a bit difficult to get your fingers on, and they took this and they made a slightly bigger custom handle for it. So I can think of a variety of uses, including the electronic stuff that I gadget around with. So maybe next time we'll have a link up in the show notes, or maybe I can find a link to put in the show notes this time. But yet something else to spend some money on. All of it's not that expensive. A fairly big bag of the stuff was just $17 mm-hmm. on eBay. So there you go.
Yeah, and I'm looking at the on the MCM site, and that's about what it costs there too. 17 ounces, $15.49.
Mm-hmm.
So there's another substance that seems a little similar that I'd come across before called Sugru. I don't know if this is familiar to you, but
it's a glue adhesive.
Glue.
Yeah. Have you guys used that?
It's flexible. Yeah. So it comes in different colors. It's moldable, and when it mm-hmm. cures, it's you can use it to put on like safety corners, bumpers, repairs. It's very handy. It's amazing what's out there.
Oh man, yeah. Those chemists. Yeah, they're really killing it. All right. Well, that's it for this show.
You gonna land us?
I'm gonna land the plane.
Rocket, I think.
the rocket. In. Yes, that's right.
In.
Stick with the theme, Earl. No, you don't want me to land us. Remember my
run.
So you could find the show notes for all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss in the forums at the newly minted vcfed.org, and the URL will be up there for that. It's the new home for the same forums, part of the Vintage Computer Federation now. You can follow RCR on Twitter at RCR Podcast. You can join our rapidly growing Facebook group. Lots of great stuff going on over there now. And thanks everyone for posting. You can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. I'll remind our listeners, we're a proud member of the Throwback Network, which you can find at throwbacknetwork.net. And if you like us, please write a review for us on iTunes. We had someone send in some feedback mentioning that they'd done just that. And tip of the hat to you, sir. We appreciate that. And until next time,
Retro Compute.
Cool. Touchdown.